EDL Radio Encore.
Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. I hope, indeed I pray, that we shall not be found unworthy of our victory if after toil and tribulation it is granted to us. For the rest, we have to gain the victory. That is our task. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
We shall not fail or falter. We shall not weaken or tire. Neither the sudden shock of battle nor the long-drawn trials of vigilance and exertion will wear us down. Give us the tools, and we will finish the job.
We shall go on to the end. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Welcome, everyone, to this edition of the English Defense League radio show. I'm a poor substitute for our host, Jeff Mitchell, But Jeff has been hospitalized with COPD, breathing problems, and he is unable to talk for very long right now. This show is being broadcast on Sunday, but it's being recorded on Friday because I have with me the real host of the show, Jan Rennie, and we're going to go through some articles and talk about the Remembrance Day and Veterans Day in the United States, and these coincide this Sunday on the 100th anniversary of the Armistice, the end of World War I, which was a brutal conflict that not enough people really know that much about, and they should, because it shaped the way war was fought thereafter. And with that, I'd like to bring in Jan Rennie. Hello, Jan.
Hello, Dave. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're basically the host today because this is the English Defense League radio show, and I know that Jeff would want for the team to be together, but this is about Remembrance Day primarily, and that means that that you're on the hot seat today.
Thank you. Thanks for that. Get well soon, Jeff. We have missed you.
Absolutely. And yeah. Jeff, I just want to say, if you look on my Facebook page, when you can get on Facebook, you will see a post from me talking about how you were coming home. Every time I check that thing, there are more and more and more supportive responses for you. I think you'll enjoy reading it, Jeff. We love you. We miss you. And we know that you're with us in spirit doing this show.
Most certainly, yes.
What we'd like to do, people, we would like to just give you an overview of World War I, because there are so many people that don't know about it. And I'm going to take this from an article from the History Channel. It's fairly complete, but it was such a long and complicated struggle that we can only do it so much justice. So here we go. At the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, the Great War ended at 5 a.m. That morning, Germany, bereft of manpower and supplies, and faced with imminent invasion, signed an armistice agreement with the Allies in a railroad car outside Compiègne, France. The First World War left 9 million soldiers dead and 21 million wounded, with Germany, Russia, Austria-Hungary, France, and Great Britain each losing nearly a million or more lives. In addition, at least 5 million civilians died from disease, starvation, or exposure. On July the 28th, 1914, an event that is widely regarded as sparking the outbreak of World War I, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, was shot to death with his wife by Bosnian Serb Gavrilo Princip in Sarajevo, Bosnia. Ferdinand had been expecting his uncle's imperial armed forces in Bosnia and Herzegovina, despite the threat of Serbian nationalists who wanted these Austro-Hungarian possessions to join newly independent Serbia. Austria-Hungary blamed the Serbian government for the attack and hoped to use the incident as justification for settling the problem of Slovak nationalism once and for all. However, as Russia supported Serbia, an Austro-Hungarian declaration of war was delayed until its leaders received assurances from German leader Kaiser Wilhelm II that Germany would support their cause in the event of a Russian intervention. Now, as I scroll down, guys, you can see here that it already just becomes a complicated furball. It was a set of alliances that had, Jan, really begun in the 19th century. And this was just a culmination of them. I don't need, Jan, to tell you that during the 19th century, a lot of the European powers, Great Britain included, wove themselves together in a web of alliances. And that's really, in my opinion, where this came from.
Yes, right? I think so too. Maybe their forces amalgamated for the
war. Well, that was part of it. It started with the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo. And then because everybody was allies with everybody else, it just snowballed from there.
Right.
Famously, they asked the Kaiser how he thought the war started once it was all over. And he said, you know, if we only knew. So even the Kaiser didn't know at the time what really started the war.
There's lots of mention of Austria-Hungary, and back in the First World War, they had the German Empire, the Ottoman Empire, and, of course, the Russian Empire, which was amalgamation of different countries, I presume, that don't exist anymore. Maybe some of the UK, we have still got the Commonwealth part of it. But things were very different back then.
Yes, they were. And now I'll continue with the article. On July the 28th, Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia, and the tenuous peace between Europe's great powers collapsed. On July the 29th, Austro-Hungarian forces began to shell the Serbian capital, Belgrade, and Russia, Serbia's ally, ordered a troop mobilization against Austria-Hungary. France, allied with Russia, began to mobilize on August the 1st. France and Germany declared war against each other on August the 3rd. After crossing through neutral Luxembourg, the German army invaded Belgium on the night of August 3-4, prompting Great Britain, Belgium's ally, to declare war against Germany. As you can see, guys, as I scroll down, this was just a bunch of diplomatic dominoes and alliances falling into place and taking a lot of countries and people with it. Now, for the most part, the people of Europe greeted the outbreak of war with jubilation, quite different from today, by the way, most particularly assured that their country would be victorious within months of the initial belligerence. Germany was most prepared for the outbreak of hostilities, and its military leaders had formatted a sophisticated military strategy known as the Schlieffen Plan, which envisioned the conquest of France through a great arcing offensive through Belgium and into northern France. Russia, slow to mobilize, was to be kept occupied by Austro-Hungarian forces while Germany attacked France. The Schlieffen Plan was nearly successful, but in early September, the French rallied and halted the German advance at the bloody Battle of the Marne River near Paris. By the end of 1914, well over a million soldiers of various nationalities had been killed on the battlefields of Europe, and neither the Allies nor the Central Powers was a final victory in sight. On the Western Front, the battle line that stretched across northern France and Belgium, the combatants settled down in the trenches for a terrible war of attrition. And as I scroll down, guys, yeah, you hear just horrific stories about trench warfare. And this is where it started. Actually, this is where it started in Europe. Actually, the strategy of using trenches began in the American Civil War, towards the end, as defensive measures. And there were people from nation states in Europe that were there observing that war and also there looking the land over in case the United States was to collapse into more than one country. But they got the idea of trench warfare from that conflict, mostly. Now, in 1915, the Allies attempted to break the stalemate with an amphibious invasion of Turkey, which had joined the Central Powers in October of 1914. But after heavy bloodshed, the Allies were forced to retreat in early 1916. The year 1916 saw great offenses by Germany and Britain along the Western Front, but neither side accomplished a decisive victory. In the East, Germany was more successful, and the disorganized Russian army suffered terrible losses, spurring the outbreak of the Russian Revolution in 1917. By the end of 1917, the Bolsheviks had seized power in Russia and immediately set about negotiating peace with Germany. In 1918, the infusion of American troops and resources into the Western Front finally tipped the scale in the Allies' favor. Germany signed an armistice agreement with the Allies on November the 11th, 1918. World War I was known as the war to end all wars because of the great slaughter and destruction it caused. Unfortunately, the peace treaty that officially ended the conflict, the Treaty of Versailles of 1919, forced punitive terms on Germany that destabilized Europe and laid the groundwork for World War II. All right, so that's that article. Now, Jan, you've got some figures of the number of dead by country.
And yes. Folks,
if you listen to this, you're going to be amazed. Jan, please go ahead.
It is quite amazing. The figures shocked me between each country. It shows just who was in the thick of battle and people who just wasn't. I'd just like to add that when we went to war, when the UK became involved in the war, or was about to, 6 million British men signed up. 3 million Brits actually went to war. And the number that died was 994,138. But I'll read you the list of... Let's start with Japan. These are the troops they lost, the people they lost that was in active service. Japan, 415. Denmark, 722. Sweden, 877. Newfoundland, 1,204. Norway, 1,892. Montenegro, misspelled some words, 3,000. South Africa, 9,463. New Zealand, 18,050. Australia, 61,928. Canada, 66,944. The Indian Empire, 74,187. Portugal, 89,222. The USA, 117,465. Belgium, 120,637. Greece, 176,000. Bulgaria, 187,500. Romania, 680,000. Serbia, 725,000. United Kingdom, 994,138. Italy, 1,240,000. Austria-Hungary, 1,567,000. France, 1,697,800. The German Empire, 2,476,897. The Ottoman Empire, 2,921,844. The Russian Empire, 3,311,000. Amazing figures, Dave, don't you think? All those millions lost.
Oh, yes. Completely shocking. And it was all because of the web of alliances that was created. And I think the numbers were also because of some of the strategies that were employed. Because you had trench warfare, and at the same time, you had advances in technology, which included more efficient artillery. And, of course, the machine gun, the Maxim gun, the Vickers gun, which was used by the UK, and of course, on the smaller arms side than those, you had things like the pump shotgun, which was used by the Americans to ward off trench raids, and of course, you had the Browning automatic rifle, which my grandfather used, actually, when he was in the war, and you also had gas, mustard gas, and they tried chlorine gas and other things, and this took a devastating toll on the regular soldiers in this war. So many countries had been using 19th century techniques to fight what was really a 20th century war. And that shows in the numbers of dead. And I really personally have a bit of a problem with some of the leadership on both sides, honestly, in that war, that they did not recognize this new technology and develop better strategies for fighting this conflict that might have resulted in the loss of fewer people. I mean, I don't know how you think about it, Jan, but that's just my personal opinion.
Well, Winston Churchill, at one point during the First World War, was, for the UK anyway, was in charge of munitions. He started off with the Admiralty. He became First Lord of the Admiralty. What year? I can't think. 1911, I think, because he was watching Germany and their building, a bit like we did in the Second World War. Right. He was watching Germany getting their manpower, their military together, and he knew that we hadn't got what you're saying, Dave. We hadn't got that military power. We hadn't got the weapons. We hadn't got the things that were needed like we had in the Second World War. And indeed now, when you look at the Falklands War, any man or woman, any man that got to the medical tent survived. No one died that was taken in there alive. They all survived, mm-hmm. whether it be Brits or the others, Argentinians. Right. But that just shows what great medical people we had within the forces. But of course, Tony Blair, we didn't find this out for a while, but Tony Blair got rid of military hospitals in the UK, which also went with military doctors and nurses, and which is a backward step when you look at the First World War. I mean, in Stirling Castle, there is a big display. It's been there for years. There is a big display of First World War medical instruments. My God, they are so rudimentary. They are, for want of a better word, blunt. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the rusty look about them now is because of age, but you may as well have had a knife and fork. And these were men. I mean, these doctors that was out, there's no doubt when people signed up for the First World War, there was doctors amongst them and medical staff, obviously, to try and save a life just outside of a trench, if you like, get wounded people from the trenches to the medics in all that mud. And it's just beyond comprehension, isn't it?
It is, really. You know, what you're talking about is very relevant, because at the start of World War One and through most of it, the technological advantage was on the side of the Central Powers, Germany and their allies. They had better aircraft. They had, well, for instance, they had one aircraft that was actually made in Holland that was just devastating as far as aircraft goes. And the only ones that could even come close were France. They were just behind them, technologically speaking. The UK did bring in tanks, but the Americans, the contribution that we made to the war, as far as technology goes, was, and again, like I said, the Browning automatic rifle and the pump shotgun. And in an odd twist of fate, Hiram Percy Maxim, I believe it was him that was trying to do that, he tried to sell his Maxim gun to the United States Army, the Maxim machine gun. He tried to sell that to the United States Army. They rejected it. So Maxim went over to Europe.
And did they use, sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
Did they use the Gatling gun in the First World War in Europe?
The Gatling gun was old technology. It worked, and it worked well, because it was simple, and a lot of people liked it. And after that, soon came a machine gun. If you guys want to look this up, it was called the Potato Digger. It was a little bit more automated. But the Maxim gun was better in that it could fire faster, and you could fire it with a little bit more accuracy. And variations on the Maxim gun were used all the way into World War II. And as I said, that was called the Vickers gun in the UK, because Maxim went around selling his machine guns to various other countries because the United States of America would not buy them. I'm not sure why our army wouldn't buy them, but we came in at a disadvantage because of that. The best that we could do to counter it was the Browning automatic rifle, which was really an amazing weapon. I mean, the thing could actually shoot through walls. And it was also, I think, a better weapon because it was single-man carryable. With a Maxim gun or a Vickers gun, you had to have a crew, because not only did you have to keep the thing fed with a belt, but you also had to keep it cool. If it's possible, I'll try and put a picture of the Maxim gun or the Vickers gun in the slides. But we have so many slides for the show that you may not see it. If you don't, just look it up. You'll see this, Jen, you've seen this before when you've seen movies and things about the war. It's that machine gun that has that big fat thing around the barrel. Now, that big fat thing was a water jacket. That's what they used to try and keep the barrel cool. You know, but everybody was playing the technology game because
they
it was...
They're saying here, I'm just looking it up quickly.
Go ahead, yeah.
That the machine gun was the most important weapon in the First World War.
I agree with that.
The development of automatic firearms was essential. So they took Maxim's gun and it discharged multiple bullets by simply activating a trigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And saying his innovation prompted wider development. Russia, Germany, and Britain used guns based on the Maxim system.
Yes, they did.
And France and Austria-Hungary used indigenous designs stolen, and they called their machine guns the Saint-Étienne and the Schwalosi.
Yes, there were some really bizarre-looking machine guns that were in use at the time, and this is why you had so many deaths, because the leadership, and again, this goes on every side, the leadership just didn't realize how devastating these weapons were. And they would send their men charging, you know, this was a big thing over here, Jan, you know, over the top.
Yeah.
Crawl out of those trenches and charge, you know. And they were charging right into the teeth of these machine guns, which is that were just cutting them up. The only thing that comes close to what happened in World War One to soldiers, the only thing that comes close to that was the Battle of Little Round Top, which was part of the Battle of Gettysburg in the American Civil War. And with that conflict, you had Confederate soldiers charging federal positions, and the United States Army used cannon on them with grape shot, which basically that's just like pointing a giant shotgun at someone and firing it off. And in one of the accounts from that battle, it was said that, and I quote, whole regiments just disappeared. I mean, there was so big a volume of fire at that point that the attacking Confederate soldiers were just disintegrated. And you didn't see anything like that again until World War One. And then they were mowing people down like they were mowing grass. Some of those machine gunners had to have had nightmares about what they were doing after the war, after they had done that.
Yeah, we have to remember that, let's just take UK as the example. When you think about 6 million men signing up and 3 million actually being involved in the war, coming up, you know, there could have been farmhands, people that worked in stores, never been to war in their life, maybe a few at the Boer War, etc., Crimean War, who knows. Even the Maxim, 500 rounds a minute, mm-hmm. and probably reached 600 metres. Mm-hmm. That would have been terrifying.
Oh, yeah.
My God, what have we come into here?
Well, it was, and yes, the armies were recruited in the UK, the same as the States. My grandfather was a farmer,
yeah.
And there were it was the same again over here. It was farmers and factory workers and men who worked in shops and just ordinary men who were drafted and when their country was called. And these
and
weapons,
also the young boys that lied about their age. We found out afterwards.
Oh yes.
How many died at 14 and 15 years of age when they were pretending to be 16, 17, you know, it's...
Well, that was patriotism.
Of course.
People really felt a love for their countries at that point. Now, Jen, I know we've got another article here. This article, people, was created by Vanda Wilcox, and it's called Combat and the Soldier's Experience in the First World War, and Jen is going to handle this one.
In a war that saw new weaponry technology and great numbers of casualties, Assistant Professor Vanda Wilcox considers the common experiences of soldiers in active combat. The men and women who served in the First World War endured some of the most brutal forms of warfare ever known. Millions were sent to fight away from home for months, even years at a time. They underwent a series of terrible physical and emotional experiences. The new technologies available to the First World War armies, combined with the huge number of men mobilized, made the battlefields of 1914 and 18 horrific, deadly and terrifying places. Technological developments in the late 19th century had made artillery and machine guns extraordinary effective defensive weapons, creating a deadly zone of fire in front of the defenders' positions. Soldiers and labourers were required to dig trenches and machine gun placements, which would protect men from enemy shelling and allow them to fire back at the enemy without exposing themselves to danger. New weapons were introduced during the war, like poison gas in 1915 and tanks in 1916, which made combat more unpredictable. Even before battle began, the experience of life in the lines could be overwhelming. Men were living outside for days and weeks on end with limited shelter from cold, wind, rain and snow in the winter or from the heat and sun in the summer. Artillery destroyed the familiar landscapes, reducing trees and buildings to desolate rubble and churning up endless mud in some areas. The incredible noise of artillery and machine gun fire, both enemy and friendly, were often incessant. Yet soldiers spent a great deal of time waiting around, and in some quiet sectors there was little real fighting, and a kind of informal truce could develop between the two sides.
Yes.
Even in more active parts of the front, battle was rarely continuous, and boredom was common among the troops, with little of the heroism and excitement many had imagined before the war. The Italian infantry officer Emilio Lusso wrote that life in the trenches was grim and monotonous, and that if there were no attacks, there was no war, only hard work. The order to attack or news of an enemy assault changed everything. Men ordered to attack or go over the top had to climb out of the trenches, carrying their weapons and heavy equipment, and move through the enemy's field of fire over complex networks of barbed wire, keeping low to the ground for safety. The objective was to reach the enemy's front line, where the defending troops would be sheltering in their own trenches and use rifles or bayonets to attack them directly. Once the defenders were eliminated, the attacking force seized the position, at least in theory. In reality, these tactics were often unsuccessful and vicious attacks were rare. Casualties were extremely high, with many men killed and wounded. Attackers often suffered higher casualties than defenders. Wounded men were carried or escorted back to field hospitals for treatment, while the dead could only be buried if there was a suitable break in the fighting. Unsurprisingly, going over the top was a terrifying experience for most soldiers. Yet it was that rare that men disobeyed the order to attack. Most First World War troops were generally compliant. What motivated men to fight under such terrible conditions? What kept their morale high despite their fear and physical exhaustion? Traditionally, the authorities believed or hoped that men would be motivated by loyalty to an idea, usually patriotism. French and Serbian soldiers were defending their homeland against invasion, while Britain, German and Austrian soldiers were encouraged to focus on their duty to their king or emperor. These ideas encouraged men to volunteer for military service and could keep their spirits high through long spells of frontline service. But once under fire, men needed more than ideals to maintain their courage. One important explanation for soldiers' resilience is the idea of the primary group. Men were motivated above all by comradeship, as they fought alongside friends and companions. Effective training also helped, making soldiers familiar with the chaos and fear of the battlefield so that their actions in battle became second nature to them. But armies did not leave men's behaviour in battle down to chance. The system of military discipline existed to coerce them into obedience. Punishments for disobeying orders could be severe, and men who were convicted of cowardice in the face of the enemy or desertion from their unit could receive the death sentence. Many hundreds of soldiers were executed by their own armies for military offences during the conflict. Some 60 million soldiers from all over the world served in First World War, fighting in locations varying from France to Iraq, Greece to China, the North Sea to the Pacific Ocean, and experiencing a huge range of types of combat. Yet wherever they fought, the impact of modern technologies combined with the political circumstances of the war made First World War combat a unique and terrible experience. And that's it. And what came to my mind there, Dave, reading that article was, I can't remember how many years ago, it's not that far back, that our men who were executed for cowardice in the First World War was exonerated. Not that it did them any good.
Right.
But at least three I read about years back that were sent by their superior officer with a note to run somewhere with the note.
Mm-hmm.
As passing messages. And they were construed as deserters. So they were shot, executed.
One more thing about the trenches, which it was a big component in this war, living in the trenches. It was just extremely awful. Anytime it rained, it just turned everything into just a river of mud. The worst thing, really, about the trenches and being in there was sometimes for the wounded, because there were reports of men who actually drowned in the mud in those trenches. And, of course, you had the gas, which was just a horrific type weapon. My grandfather spoke about men who had been hit by mustard gas, and of course he had been too. But there were men that came out of that war because of what mustard gas does, because it binds with whatever water there is that comes off of the human body. there were men that obviously were blinded. There were men who came out of that war with no noses and with just holes where their ears used to be. Just living with that as well, this was a horrifying war. And it is a good thing that the countries after that war decided not to use gas, because for one thing, it was a weapon that could, if the wind changed, affect your own troops. And that was something that a lot of people found out to their detriment. But this was a vicious, vicious war. And we owe a great debt to all of our people who went through that hell and did what they did, whether it was for their country, or for king and country, for patriotism, for comradeship, or whatever. I seriously doubt that our young people today who are claiming PTSD because of the 2016 election could have endured that sort of thing.
Yes. I'm sorry for laughing, but I remember reading that post and I'm thinking, they've got PTSD because Mr. Trump became president. I mean, put him in the middle of a war and let them find out what PTSD is.
Exactly. My cousin, Tommy Milner, served with distinction in the Vietnam War. And, of course, I've got other family that served. And so do you. You've got family that served as well. Mm-hmm. And it's really insulting to have these pukes come out and say, oh, I've got PTSD. You don't even know what PTSD is. No idea. Try coming back from Vietnam with malaria and you're just trying to get through with your life and just go along and work and do what you have to do, you know, but then an attack comes on. And this is years later. And you have to go and lay down for a while because you can't do anything else. That's what malaria does. And my cousin was one of the luckier ones. He didn't have something shot off. You know, he didn't step on an IED and lose a foot or a leg. So for these people to, in the face of people like my cousin and other people who came out of these wars with serious injuries, to whine about having PTSD because their woman didn't win in a stupid election is just massively insulting to me, and I think to any right-thinking person. But we're getting off the track a little bit, but one of the things that we wanted to talk about, folks, was veterans of the First World War lived for quite a long time afterward. And Jan, I know that there's a veteran, the last surviving British veteran of World War One, that you'd like to read about.
Yes, her name was Florence Green. She died 2 weeks before her 111th birthday. She is the world's last surviving First World War veteran. Female, anyway. British. Mrs. Green passed away in her sleep at a care home in Norfolk just 2 weeks before her 111th birthday. The great-grandmother signed up to the Women's Royal... Well, it wasn't the Royal Air Force back then. It was the Royal Air Corps. Women's Royal Air Corps, 93 years ago in September 1918, when she was just 17. She was the last surviving person to have served in World War One, following the death of British-born sailor Claude Charles in Australia last year. During the First World War, Mrs. Green worked at Narborough Airfield and RAF Marham in Norfolk as an officer's mess steward. Mrs. Green, who was born in London, lived with her daughter May, 90. Imagine having a daughter, 90.
Yeah.
In King's Lynn, Norfolk, but had moved into Briar House care home shortly before Christmas, where she died on Saturday. Her family paid tribute to the veteran, describing her as a great woman. Her daughter May said she so nearly made it to her 111th birthday. It is very sad. We are grateful for all the nice tributes. Mrs. Green's younger daughter, June Everts, from Oundle, Northants, 76, said, I'm very proud of her, and she was very proud of the recognition she received. Mrs. Green spent her war days working all hours, serving officers breakfast, lunch and dinner, and would often spend time wandering the base simply admiring the pilots. Oh, my goodness me. Sounds like something I'd do.
It does, doesn't it?
Before her death, she says, I enjoyed my time in the Air Force. There were plenty of people at the airfield where I worked, and they were all very good company. I would work every hour God sent, but I had dozens of friends on the base and we had a great deal of fun in our spare time. In many ways, I had the time of my life. I met dozens of pilots and would go on dates. I had the opportunity to go up in one of the planes, but I was scared of flying. But it was a lovely experience, and I'm very proud. Her story came to light after Andrew Holmes, the British correspondent for the US-based Gerontology Research Group, traced her name using the National Archives. Mr. Holmes tracks and validates the ages of people over 110 and also keeps track of British men and women who are older than 107. Thank you, Mr. Holmes. That's nice of you. Mr. Holmes traced further and was surprised to find Florence had joined the WRAF in September 1918, 2 months before the war ended in November 1918. He said it is a common misconception that veterans must be someone who saw action or fighting in the trenches. A veteran is someone who served in one of the armed forces, regardless of their role. A medic, an ambulance driver, or a waitress, they all count. Yes, of course they do. Last May, the only living male First World War combat veteran, British-born sailor Claude Charles, died in Australia at the age of 110. What memories they must have had, Dave, just sitting talking to them. Can you imagine?
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, actually, I can. Because, again, because of my grandfather.
Yeah, well, I was to my grandfather, too. And but I was a child then, and you take some of it in. And spoke French fluently, and he was in the trenches, but I probably turned my head at that time, being 10-year-old and not interested so much, but, you know. RAF squadron leader Paula Wilmot said RAF Marham, where Mrs. Green was stationed for 7 months, would pay its respects to the veteran in true style. We will be supporting the family at the funeral. We are sending a number of our stewards as a tribute to her. And it goes on to say we kept in contact with her just before Christmas to give her a Christmas cake, which she was delighted with. So it's actually amazing that several veterans have gone over the age of 100 years, Dave.
Oh, yes, it is. And we were talking about this, folks, before the show, and it's just coincidental. But there's an American veteran, the last surviving American veteran of World War One who died, was 110 as well. Now, this comes from the New York Slimes, and it is dated February the 28th, 2011. And the headline here is Frank Buckles, last World War One doughboy, is dead at 110. Frank Buckles, who drove an army ambulance in France in 1918 and came to symbolize a generation of embattled young Americans as the last of the World War One doughboys, died on Sunday at his home in Charlestown, West Virginia. He was 110. His death was announced on his website. He was only a corporal, and he never got closer than 30 or so miles to the Western Front trenches. But Mr. Buckles became something of a national treasure as the last living link to the 2 million men who served in the American Expeditionary Forces in France in the war to end all wars. President Obama said in a statement that Mr. Buckles lived a remarkable life that reminds us of the true meaning of patriotism and our obligations to each other as Americans. Frail, stooped, and hard of hearing, but sharp of mind, Mr. Buckles was named Grand Marshal of the National Memorial Day Parade in Washington in 2007. He was a guest at Arlington National Cemetery on Veterans Day 2007 for wreath-laying ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknowns. He was honored by Defense Secretary Robert M. Gates at the Pentagon and met with President George W. Bush at the White House in March of 2008. United States senators played host to him at the Capitol in June of 2008 for the impending 90th anniversary of the World War One armistice, and he appeared before a Senate subcommittee in December 2009 to support legislation named in his honor to bestow federal status on a World War One memorial on the Washington Mall built in the 1930s. The Department of Veterans Affairs said he would be buried at Arlington National Cemetery with full military honors. Sought out for interviews in his final years, Mr. Buckles told of witnessing a ceremony involving British veterans at the Crimean War fought in the 1850s when he was stationed in England before heading to France. He remembered chatting with General John J. Pershing, the commander of American troops in World War I, at an event in Oklahoma City soon after the war's end. Now, there's a name dropper for you. And he proudly held a sepia-tone photograph of himself in his doughboy uniform when he was interviewed by USA Today in 2007. "I was a snappy soldier," he said, "all gung-ho." Frank Woodruff Buckles was born February the 1st, 1901, on a farm near Bethany, Missouri. He was living in Oakwood, Oklahoma, when the United States entered World War I, and he tried to enlist in the Marine Corps at age 16, having been inspired by recruiting posters. He was one of those that, Jan, that you were talking about, who would willingly lie about his age to get into the war. I mean,
I wonder how many 15, 16-year-olds would lie about their age to get to war today. Not many.
Oh, no, not many at all. The Marines turned him down as underaged and under the required weight. The Navy did not want him either, saying he had flat feet. But the Army took him in August 1917 after he lied about his age, there you go, and he volunteered to be an ambulance driver, hearing that was the quickest path to service in France. He sailed for England in December 1917 on the Carpathia.
The Carpathia.
Yes, we both know about that one. The Carpathia, yeah. People, it was another one of the big liners. That was, the Carpathia, the ship that helped save survivors of the Titanic's sinking in 1912. He later served in various locations in France, including Bordeaux, and drove military autos and ambulances. He was moved by the war's impact on the French people. "The little French children were hungry," Mr. Buckles recalled in a 2001 interview for the Veterans History Project of the Library of Congress. "We'd feed the children. To me, that was a pretty sad sight." Mr. Buckles escorted German prisoners of war back to their homeland after the armistice, then returned to the United States and later worked in the Toronto office of the White Star Shipping Line. There's going full circle for you, Jan.
What an interesting life. What an interesting life, though.
Yes, it was. It was.
Strangely enough, Winston Churchill was refused twice to join military service as a young man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It really is amazing. This guy was was almost a Renaissance man. I mean, just to hear of all of the things that he did. And folks, that's not all of that article, but we're going to have to stop it here because we only have a couple of hours to do this. You know, but he was an amazing man that traveled all over the world. And he was one of those unsung heroes that the article that Jan read talked about. Those people that got the wounded to the hospital tents so that they could be cared for. It's really very amazing.
Just reading up here on mustard gas, I'm trying to find out if it was the first chemical warfare used in the world. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. You could die from between 1 and 2 days in normal weather. Mustard gas killed you. Mm-hmm. But it could go on and kill you slowly, breaking down your body slowly for years.
Yes.
If you lived in a cold country, it took you years to die. But you must have been dying in agony, of course. It was a terrible, terrible thing to use. I'm just reading about that now. It's also a blister agent, and it rots away different parts of the body. It's horrendous. To think that they used something like that in the First World War is amazing.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It creates an acid on your skin, and that's what eats away at it. And I do not know this for certain, but to this day, I think that it must have had something to do with my grandfather's contraction of cancer that eventually killed him in 1980. It was a horrible, horrible weapon and is well gone from use in almost all conflicts. And we know, of course, that it's been used sporadically here and there since, but never on the scale that it was in the First World War. Now, people, we're going to shift to the modern day and what kind of help our veterans are getting now, what kind of honor they're getting now as our nation's leaders are going to ceremonies to mark the 100th anniversary of the armistice. What is being done for our veterans at this point? And Jan, you have an article from The Guardian.
Yes, it's Commonwealth veterans living in poverty set for a £12 million UK aid boost. This is for the Commonwealth, I believe, and not for anyone living in the UK. Aid funding of £12 million will be used to help thousands of impoverished war veterans who served with the British Army across the Commonwealth.
Oh, well.
Penny Mordaunt has announced. The Minister for International Development said the cash would be used to provide two meals a day and regular cash transfers to 7,000 veterans and war widows who served in the British Armed Forces. The programme will run in more than 30 countries. £7 million's not going to go far in 30 countries, is it?
No, it's not.
Including India, Kenya and Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, as you can break this down afterwards, but I'm just shocked at this Zimbabwe, which was formerly Rhodesia, was it not?
Right, yes.
I never knew that they were part of the Commonwealth. That's new to me. Anyway, where some veterans and war widows are struggling to afford the equivalent of one meal a day. The announcement by the Department for International Development follows concern over the plight of hundreds of Commonwealth veterans, some of whom are in their 90s, living in poverty in Zimbabwe. We owe a tremendous amount to these Commonwealth veterans. The British public would be shocked to know that those who had served alongside our armed forces would be living in such poverty, Mordaunt said. It is absolutely right to make this commitment. I think the British public would approve of us pledging this support because of the sacrifices the Commonwealth veterans have made and because of the debt of gratitude we owe to them. The announcement comes ahead of Armistice Day commemorations on Sunday. About 4,500 veterans and 2,500 widows will receive cash transfers through the Royal Commonwealth Ex-Service League, RCEL. The League's Deputy Grand President, Lord Richards of Hurstmonceux, a former Chief of Defence Staff, said, "We owe a great deal of debt to the servicemen and women of the Commonwealth who served in the British Armed Forces in the Second World War and afterwards prior to their country's independence. This grant will help the RCEL ensure that these brave men and women are sustained and cared for in their twilight years. As important, it will let them know that they have not been forgotten and that their service and sacrifice is remembered. Among those who will benefit from the initiative are Boto Morong, 99, from Gambia, who served in the Royal Army Medical Corps in Burma between 42 and 47, and Sipoi Penhongo Igong from Nagaland, India, who fought in Kohima and Burma during the Second World War. However, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which sets the rules for global aid spending, cautioned against upsetting community dynamics following DFID's announcement. The OECD said it would not decide on whether the cash is eligible to count as overseas development assistance until next year, when the UK reports its 2018 flows. Here we go. Yasmin Ahmad, head of aid statistics at the organisation, said, "Certainly given that these funds will be provided to people living in poverty in Commonwealth developing countries, they could fall within the ODA definition." But she questioned why the support was for veterans of UK Armed Forces and not all veterans living below the poverty line, and said the contributions would need to be made in a sensitive way, for instance, if certain war veterans were offered support and their neighbours were not. I think Miss Yasmin Ahmad wants us to pay everybody in the country, whether they served or not, reading that. An estimated 4.5 million Commonwealth soldiers from the Indian subcontinent, Africa, and the Caribbean fought in the British Army during the Second World War. Of the 14,000 veterans who survive, half are now living in poverty.
So that shows, Jen, what the UK is doing for Commonwealth soldiers. But as mm-hmm. you said, this isn't about soldiers from the UK. This isn't about veterans from the UK. And when you talk about this, it's not just veterans of World War I anymore, obviously. This goes right down the line to veterans from the Falklands War, right down to Afghanistan. And at this point, for those who have been following Tommy Robinson, who is an author and a journalist and who started the English Defense League and is a civil rights leader, you know that he has been hard at work championing the UK's military. And I'm going to play for you now an audio from Mr. Robinson, which he recorded on the 8th of this month.
On our way to Newport to meet a fella called Gus, who's an ex-serviceman, who's on hunger strike. He's 9 days in. He's sleeping outside of combat stress. I believe he's an ex-veteran, 62 years old, who's suffering with post-traumatic stress disorder, and he's making a complaint, or having a protest, about his treatment, about how our ex-veterans are being treated. He's 9 days in. He could die from doing this. So we're going to catch up and find out what it's all about. So I've only got snippets of actually what's happened and why you're protesting. Mind filling me in?
Yeah, well, today I said this is an open chair. Anybody who wants to come is welcome to come. So thank you for coming. I mean, believe it or not, you've beaten most of the politicians I invited to come.
What is this? Is it like a medical centre for combat stress?
Stress. It's specialist for, post-traumatic stress disorder. They got treatment here. Well, at some point they ran out of funding, kicked everybody out, and it's empty.
You've got post-traumatic stress disorder. So you've been coming here regularly.
Yeah.
It helps you. Did it help you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it kept me on a level keel, you know.
And then just like that,
stopped,
gone?
Gone.
No direction of where to go for the same treatment?
Clear off.
Just gone?
Gone, that's it. No discharge report, no follow-up care, nothing, just gone. Now, what's happened, this has happened to hundreds of guys now, and they've been turning up here since I've sat here to tell their stories. Guys have been in there, have left, and committed suicide, and it's directly attributable to the fact that they were discharged here without any medical backup, without any medical intervention or support or anything. I've been to funerals of guys who've committed suicide who I served down south with. It's heartbreaking. I've been trying to kind of get some answers from this organisation for 3 years through my MPs, you name it. Nothing. So this
for 3 years, three years you've been trying to find out why nothing's happening,
yep.
And now you're sitting here.
It's the last resort.
Where did you serve?
Falklands.
Paratrooper.
Paratrooper. Yeah, yeah. Paratrooper engineer. So engineer support for the parachute regiment, and three tours of Northern Ireland. So I did my bit, you know. And this is what it's come down to.
You're on hunger strike.
I haven't eaten a thing for 10 days. And I'm pretty bollocks.
After 7 days, your internal organs start becoming damaged.
Yes,
irreversibly.
Let's put it this way. I'm coming to the winter of my life, you know. We stand on the precipice of an avalanche of Falklands, Iraqi and Afghanistan vets are going to come forward in the next 10 years. And unless it changes. I would like to think, I mean, I'm prepared to sacrifice my life if it comes to that. Don't want to, you know, I'll make it through till Sunday. But if you think this through, right, I would like to leave this life thinking that the next generation of veteran is not going to have the 30 years that I've had over this condition. So my life will have been worthwhile if I can save those guys and come in with proper structures in place. Lots of political bluster where they said, oh, we're putting this in place and that in place. But this is the 100th anniversary of the First World War, where shell shock was first noticed, first come to the light, and I'm sitting outside of an empty building that could be looking after these blokes, and there's blokes on the streets. So it says it all. If the government says to me we ain't got the facilities, oh yes we have, because it's there. I'm looking at it now, that's why I'm here.
If you want to show support, go to www.savecombatstress.com. This would first off be about getting this charity the funding they need. Getting them the funding they need. And also, you've said an independent inquiry into how, say that out loud, men are coming here suffering with mental problems from war. And then all of a sudden overnight, they just close it down. They get a letter saying you're discharged. Even though they're still mentally unwell, you're discharged. There's a building here that can house 100 people or help 100 people. So that's the ask, what you'll be asking for. Yeah. And
and that doesn't seem unreasonable. That seems a reasonable thing to be.
Aftercare, mental aftercare for people who sacrifice their lives, who are willing to die, who are suffering in their homes, in their families, in the streets. Your relationships, their whole lives are suffering from mental problems caused from war. War that they were sent to by our government. And then they're left.
So, Jen, you've heard this audio from Tommy Robinson. Your impressions?
I think that in light of this audio and what Tommy Robinson has been doing, it is like someone finally who's in the public eye has spoken out about it. I know that soldiers have spoken about it for years in the past and in the present, but they've never had anyone to bring it to the fore. With Tommy Robinson doing that, will it make any difference? I doubt it very much. I've just read the article where we're looking after the Commonwealth, and although it's not a great deal of money, they don't mention Canada, New Zealand,
Australia,
and any other Commonwealth country. It just seems to be Zimbabwe, other parts of Africa, and parts of India. I'm not sure that... Are they being judgmental? Do they think that everybody in Canada and Australia are doing fine and it's great, so we don't recognise them? The British Commonwealth is quite large, so why would you single out three main countries? And they seem to be leaning more towards Zimbabwe. I'm just perplexed as to... Like, Tommy Robinson is trying... When you hear about British soldiers being fired for having a photograph taken with Tommy Robinson, for those of you that in other parts that's not in the UK and haven't heard about it, Tommy Robinson pulled up at a petrol station, a gas station, and a bunch of soldiers on a truck saw him, and obviously they all spoke, and the next thing they're all being charged, one got booted out of the army for being with Tommy and they're being ostracised, picked on. It's unbelievable what's going on. We don't have freedom of speech. Now we can't even have our photographs taken or talk to someone who's in the public eye. It's crazy. Absolutely crazy.
Well, and he also speaks, Jen, of the fact that current British serving have to buy their own food. Their food isn't even provided for them by the government. And no. I have to think, Jen, that some of this has to have to do with the fact that migrants are being given everything when they come over.
Yes.
And I'm just going to say it, you know, Islamic migrants.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
And at the same time, in the UK, and this is also true in the United States, Americans, don't think that I've forgotten about our veterans, because I haven't. We've got veterans that are living on the street because they can't find a place to live. Now, in the UK, that's because the public housing there favors migrants instead of the veterans. So these men and women are living rough out on the street, and nobody's taking care of them. What I find interesting, Jan, and this shows you the reach that Tommy Robinson has, is that the media finally got hold of this. Now, I don't know if this audio comes from Sky News or the BBC or who it comes from, but they finally decided that they were going to go around after Tommy Robinson had finished his live feed and have a talk with Gus Hales.
Yeah, Jane, Mr. Hales has been here for 11 days now outside this combat stress treatment centre in Newport, Shropshire. This is your 11th day of fasting, isn't it,
yeah.
Gus? How are you feeling?
Pretty washed out, pretty tired, still lucid, still determined to go to Remembrance Day, but I feel myself getting weaker each day.
And you've been sleeping in that tent behind us. How's that been?
A former paratrooper, went through the Falklands War. Quite endure it in a strange sort of way.
And why did you feel you had to take these extreme measures?
Lots of reasons, really, but we can see that treatment of veterans returning from combat is woefully inadequate. I think somebody said there was a suicide last night, which brings the yearly total to about 57, I believe. There was 14 in October, and I think it's 4 this month, November already, so... the treatment just doesn't seem to be there. It doesn't seem to be together or packaged, and that's got to change. It's the 100th anniversary of the First World War since shell shock was first recognised. Today they call it combat-related PTSD, and things need to change.
What do you want to see change?
Maybe dedicated centres paid for by the government, because it was the government I was employed by, it was the government that sent me to war, and we seem to be farmed off to this charity that it costs billions. And the war doesn't just stop on the day of the ceasefire, when the guns go silent. It's a continuing war for a veteran. The sights and sounds and smells he's experienced will stay with him for the rest of his life.
And what symptoms are you experiencing? Of course, so you've had an unreserved apology from combat stress.
Yes.
For being discharged in 2015. What have been your struggles since then?
Really, after the discharge, I wrote to this organisation to ask why I was discharged. That still hasn't been answered. There's been an apology, but I still don't know why I was discharged. And according to the NICE guidelines, this should be a proper care discharge package, which I'm still waiting for. So I don't know where I am regarding this organisation who treated me for so long. I would like a discharge plan so I can take it perhaps to another organisation and say this is what they did for me, this is where I am. But although there's been an unconditional apology, I still have not got that.
So Jan, what do you think of this panther-like response from the media, just jumping all over this story after Tommy Robinson had spoken of it in one of his live feeds?
Well, it's just typical of the media, isn't it? And it's just all liberalism. We're surrounded by liberal media that will not publish the truth. They go against everything that we know is right. They go against any principle. It's like a breakdown of, let's condemn the soldier. Look at the response we've had in the UK alone. I've known people walk in. A gentleman last 2 days ago went into a grocery store and he had a Help for Heroes shirt on. And the girl behind the counter refused to serve him because he was racist.
Right.
They are now turning the poppy, which we celebrate on the 11th of the 11th. I say commemorate, not celebrate, commemorate. About the First World War primarily, but it also covers any soldiers or service people that's died in wars since 1918. They are now turning it into racism. It's not being talked about in this. Our children do not know the first meaning of the First World War. I must admit, there's one channel on one of our televisions that's been commemorating all week, doing a great job about the poppies and our service people. But now they're turning it around. There is even a movement within universities and within so-called, what are they called? They call themselves celebrities and MPs. They want it stopped because we are glorifying war. Now, we're glorifying war. This is what they're saying. And yet we are protecting people that want war. It's like Churchill said after the First World War, the West is to blame for watching and allowing the war to develop into what it did. We're doing that today with the Islamists, with the invasion of Islam, the protection of Islam, our free speech being removed because... Right, we'll call it free speech. We keep going about free speech. It's turning into blasphemy laws.
Mm-hmm.
If we say something about Islam, we are blasphemous towards Allah. This is where it's turning. This is how it's going to develop in the next few months. Wait and see. Back to our soldiers. They will never give our soldiers any help. They will never do a thing for our soldiers because I'm damn sure part of our governments hate the soldiers, hate what represents anything military. I mean, you've got the leader of the Labour Party who goes to dinner with IRA terrorists, who supports Hamas. And I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't get into power at the next election. And when he does, we're in big trouble, folks. Our soldiers lying in the streets. They're not getting any treatment for PTSD. You know, this war in Afghanistan, Iraq, it's been ongoing all these years. And they're back and forth, back and forth. God knows what they see. God knows what they witness. You know, it's... I've witnessed myself how soldiers react when they come home on leave. And they're not actually sleeping. They're always on guard. They don't rest. There is no mental rest, even when they're home. And we're doing nothing. It's time we put our forces first and the immigrants last.
And I agree with that, Jen, and I just want to echo that for the United States of America. There is no reason, people, why our serving military should have to get food stamps because their pay is so low. And there is absolutely no reason that our veterans should be underserved. But as Jen says, there is an attitude among the political class in both our nations and in much of the rest of the West that is being infused into academia. They're both feeding on each other. And Jen is going to read an article that typifies this attitude.
Cambridge, you know, Cambridge University, oh my. What is it about these universities and schools? They're being taught liberalism. Okay. Cambridge University Student Union, CUSU, has voted down a motion to promote Remembrance Sunday amid fears about the glorification of conflict. The motion called on the university, its colleges and faculties to be more proactive in promoting the cause of remembrance. This could include asking for a minute's silence on Remembrance Sunday or sending email reminders to students about the availability of poppies, the motion said. It encouraged the commemoration of British veterans, adding that CUSU should ensure that Remembrance Day becomes a well-established and well-marked event across the university. But the motion, which was put forward by two members of the university's Conservative Association, was rejected. How dare they use the word conservative? Was rejected by students during their first meeting of the new academic year. James Palmer, Mayor of Cambridgeshire and Peterborough, said, "The motion brings great shame to Cambridge and shows disdain for the armed forces." He told the Daily Telegraph, "It is something I find very difficult to comprehend, that students can't be grateful and respectful of previous generations and their sacrifices. It is easy to judge from a distance when you have the luxury of a safe and comfortable democracy. We have an enormous debt to armed forces in this country." Cambridge University's Conservative Association said it was shocking that the motion was not passed, as they accused students of seeking to erase the memory of veterans. Timor Koskan, the association's chair, said that while Remembrance Sunday events are held across the university, many students, unfortunately, do not wear poppies. He added, "We want the Students' Union to promote the poppy appeal and raise money for struggling veterans' charities. The amendment, which CUSU Council overwhelmingly voted to accept, had the clear intention of de-emphasising the sacrifices made by our brave armed forces, something which Remembrance Day in particular seeks to promote." A spokesman for Cambridge Students' Union said discussions were not about erasing the past, but rather broadening the focus on our remembrance to include those who suffered and died wherever they were in the world. I presume that's soldiers. "We are a global university with students drawn from more than 120 countries, many of whom choose to recognise remembrance in different ways." The spokesman added that presidents of both the undergraduate and postgraduate student unions will lay wreaths at Remembrance Sunday event. And this is the way we're heading, people. They're already calling for the ban of poppies, the ban of Remembrance Day, and want to turn it into let's remember that, you know, we caused the conflicts. We're promoting war. How are we promoting war when we're remembering the sacrifices of all these millions of people over the years, not just the First World War, Crimea, Boer War? You're talking the senseless lives lost everywhere. Vietnam War. Yes. There's one war that I hate is the Vietnam War.
Like so many other wars, Jan, it wasn't really fought as a war. The determination to defeat communism on the Vietnam Peninsula wasn't there. It wasn't there. And that is the real shame. It wasn't in the quality of the fighting men and people who went over there. That wasn't it. And it wasn't in the quality of the South Vietnamese army. That wasn't it either. It was in a movement since the Korean War, which said that we can't fight wars full bore, straight on, like we did World War I. That we can't mark an enemy and deal with them until they can't fight anymore, and then we can declare victory and the people that they might have repressed can be free. It's no longer about that, and it hasn't been about that for 70 years, 70 plus years. So this is, Jan, where we are. And for my part, I want to say to my American brothers and sisters, if you see a veteran, if you know of a veteran or anybody currently serving, just go up to them and say thank you. Don't, I'm hearing this from veterans, Jan, over here. Don't just go up and formulaically say thank you for your service, okay? Tell them that you thank them and that you appreciate what they did and what they're doing. And buy them a cup of coffee or something if that's in your means, or maybe buy them lunch or something like that. But remember that they put themselves in harm's way for you. And Jan, I know you've got sentiments you want to express that way as well.
Yes, of course, to any service person, they are mostly men that's on the streets, unfortunately. And in the UK, they are now... The cops have nothing better to do but to go around and start removing their sleeping bags or moving them on in this cold weather, you know. In the odd cities, they have trucks that give away soup, but that normally happens, you know, Christmas, New Year, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Our soldiers that's homeless, and indeed even the ones that come back from war, you know, they're struggling. They're not the best paid people on the planet anyway, you know, they have to pay for their own food. In many cases, they've had to buy their own equipment. This is the state of this country that I believe it was Tony Blair that started demoralizing and removing certain, I'm not going to say the word, benefits in the British Army, because they never were, you know, they're risking their lives for just a pay.
They were
very, very poorly paid until Margaret Thatcher got in power. She was the first one to give them a pay rise. I don't think they get much since. It's like, I don't know, Theresa May, does she care about our soldiers? Oh, she'll pretend to on Sunday.
Certainly.
And what happens is you see Tony Blair with his poppy on, who literally got thousands of soldiers killed. And then you see the leader of the Labour Party, that skank Corbyn. He said he'll be there, but he might not wear a poppy. Well, we don't want him there. We don't want him there. We have got, you know, and when our soldiers like Tommy Robinson are talking to them, it just shows how low their morale is. Not only is any benefits like paying for their own food, buying their own equipment and everything else, they're being demoralized all the time mentally. About 5-6 years ago, they were recruiting from the West Indies. And I was down in a military base, and I said, where are all these West Indians coming from? They'd been recruited for half the pay of a British soldier. But they were so poor back there, I don't know, St. Lucia, Trinidad, wherever, they were just grateful to get that money. And the first thing I thought of was cannon fodder. How dare they recruit in a poor country? Yeah, it's part of the Commonwealth, used to be, whatever. I don't know which islands or which now. But to recruit on half the pay And then they're still paying for their own meals. But they felt they were rich because they had more money than they would have done back home. It's not right. It's just not right.
No, it isn't. And I would just like to say that as patriots in both of our countries, we have to keep the focus on our leaders as much as possible. If it requires that we shame them and put the plight of these people in their face, then we need to do that. If it requires that we let more people know about the conditions that they're living under, we should do that. Part of the reason that we did want to do this show wasn't just to mark the 100th anniversary of the armistice. We wanted to do it. Jan felt strongly about this, and so did I, for our veterans and current serving military now. We need to take care of them now. And we need to do things like President Trump did. And for the people who are listening to all of this mess that the left is putting about him being a racist and a white nationalist and an anti-Semite and all this garbage, just remember that he was the one who cared enough to sign the VA reform bill. This comes from an article published on June the 23rd, 2017 by CNN. President Donald Trump made good on a campaign promise Friday, signing into the law legislation that gives leadership at the Department of Veterans Affairs power to fire failed employees and protect those who uncover wrongdoing at the agency. For many years, the government failed to keep its own promises to our veterans. We all remember the nightmare that veterans suffered during the VA scandals that were exposed a few years ago, Trump said during remarks in the East Room at the White House. Veterans were put on secret wait lists, given the wrong medication, given bad treatments, and ignored in moments of crisis for them, he said. Many veterans died waiting for a simple doctor's appointment. What happened was a national disgrace, and yet some of the employees involved in these scandals remained on the payrolls. Outdated laws kept the government from holding those who failed our veterans accountable. Today, Trump said, we are finally changing those laws. The law, which won bipartisan support in both the Senate and House. See what happens, folks, when you have a Congress that actually cooperates with the president? Comes after years of stories about chaos inside the VA. That's for our British brothers and sisters. That's our Veterans Administration. They handle things like medical care for our veterans, including CNN investigations in 2013 and 2014 that found dozens of veterans died or were seriously injured because of long wait times at hospitals across the country. And that, Jan, is the sort of thing that our leaders need to do in the West, in the UK. They need to keep doing them in the United States. We have a new Congress here in the United States that's going to take power in January. And they are going to try and do, I'm sure, what they're doing over in the UK as far as denying our veterans and our current serving military what they need. And we have to make sure that even though the Democrats now have a majority in the House, that they do not do these sorts of things to our veterans. If it means shutting down the country until the 2020 election, then I say so be it. Mm-hmm. Because our veterans and our serving military are that important. If a few fat cat computer keyboard punchers don't come to work for a few months or even for a few years, and our veterans get the benefits they need, then frankly, I'm so good with it. Frankly good with it. And Jan, I'm really hoping in the UK that as dark as it looks now, that your people can get together through people like Tommy Robinson, through his information, and get good things done for your veterans. because it is vital. These people really just sacrificed. I've often said, Jan, for me, the possibly the worst thing about serving in the military would have to have been, and by the way, I would have served if I had had the, you know, the vision to do it, would have been to have to say yes, sir, and no, sir, to jerks. Because yeah. That's what you have to do. You, I'm sure, Jan, have heard plenty of stories about this. Just people who are, to use maybe a Britishism, you know, right bastards. And yet, you have to salute them and say yes, sir, and no, sir. And just that alone, and not being able to say, hey, guess what, boss, bite me, and walk away, which I know because I've done that, is a huge sacrifice. And that's before the substandard medical care. That's before, in the UK, having to buy your own food, and in the United States, having to use food stamps. That's before getting shot at. Jan, before I turn it over to you for final remarks, I just want to say to the listeners that as we mark the 100th anniversary of Armistice, we remember that there are those who are still serving and those who have served that require and are due our highest respect. I thank God for them. And Jeff, get well fast, and Jeff will be back with us as soon as he possibly can on the English Defense League radio show.
I'm sure he will, and I'm sure he will have his own commemoration, because Jeff is a great patriot. He loves his military. He loves his country. He loves America, as I do.
We love him right back, Jan.
Thank God for Mr. Trump. You don't know how envious the patriots of the UK are that we don't have Mr. Trump. His mother was Scottish. He could come here.
No, you don't get him.
He's part British. yes, I echo what you've said, Dave. God bless our soldiers. God bless our service people. Whichever force they're in, where would we be without them? Quite weak. Maybe that's what they want. The liberals want the countries to be weak for whatever reason. They claim to love their country, and yet they're doing everything to sabotage our cultures, our history, our people. It's our military that keeps us strong, keeps us resilient to outside pressures. It's a sad time, because the dying of servicemen and women will continue. As we speak now, I'm sure someone's lost their life in some Far Eastern rat hole that they keep sending them to. God bless you all, and keep the faith. I'm not sure when this song was written. It is about the First World War. It's called The Green Fields of France, colloquially known as William McBride. And when you hear it, you'll understand every word of it. I think there's about 7 verses. It's a shame to miss one out, actually, because they're all quite prophetic, if you like. Yeah, The Green Fields of France. It's all about World War One, Great War, as they call it. It's been a pleasure doing the show with you, Dave, and thank you to all our listeners. And keep the faith, and God bless you all. God bless the US. God bless the UK. And I'd like to say good night to you all, and we'll see you soon on the next EDL radio show. And I'm sure Jeff will be back. Good night. God bless you all.
Well, how do you do, young Willie McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside and rest for a while? Need the warm summer sun. I've been walking all day and I'm nearly done. I see by your gravestone you are only 19 when you joined the great fallen in 1916. I hope you died well, and I hope you died clean.
Our young Willie McBride was it slow and obscene. Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Did you leave it a wife or a sweetheart behind? In some faithful heart is your memory enshrined? Although you died back in 1916, in that fateful heart, are you forever 19? Or are you a stranger without even a name, enclosed and forever behind the glass frame? In an old photograph, torn, battered and stained, and faded to yellow in the brown leather frame. Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did I sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? And did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? The sun, now it shines on the green fields of France. There's a warm summer breeze that makes the red poppies dance. And look how the sun shines from under the clouds. There's no gas, no barbed wire, there's no gun firing now. But here in this graveyard, it's still no man's land. The countless white crosses stand mute in the sand. To man's blind indifference to his fellow man, to a whole generation that were butchered and damned. Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Ah, young Willie, my bride, I can't help wonder why. Do those that lie here know why did they die? And did they believe when they answered the call? Did they really believe that this war would end war? Well, the sorrow, the suffering, the glory, the pain, the killing and dying were all done in vain. For young Willie McBride, it all happened again and again and again and again and again. Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? And did the pipes play the flowers of the forest?